This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, April 25th, 2024. The Supreme Court hears oral argument in Trump v. U.S. about whether Donald Trump has presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts in office, or if he can be prosecuted for allegedly trying to overturn his loss in the 2020 presidential election. We'll hear parts of the lawyers' exchanges with the justices and talk about the case with Politico's senior legal affairs correspondent Josh Gerstein. President Joe Biden goes to Syracuse, New York to announce a multi-billion dollar Chips and Science Act award for a new computer chip factory. Federal Communications Commission votes to reinstate net neutrality rules, which prohibits broadband providers from varying internet speeds based upon how much some sites pay. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu calls for a greater crackdown on pro-Palestinian protests on U.S. college campuses. We'll hear from him and from the U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in China to talk about fair trade. And Kim Kardashian, the reality TV star and criminal justice reform advocate, joins Vice President Kamala Harris at the White House as part of Second Chance Month. Josh Gerstein, Politico's senior legal affairs reporter, writes at Politico.com, the already slim likelihood that Donald Trump will face a criminal trial brought by special counsel Jack Smith before the 2024 election appeared to dwindle further Thursday in the face of withering scrutiny from the Supreme Court's conservative majority. Josh Gerstein joins us now to discuss the oral argument in the case Trump v. U.S. about the claim of presidential immunity. Thanks, as always, for being with us. What did you hear that made you draw that conclusion?
Well, I think sort of fairly early in the argument, we heard from a couple of justices who you would think might be pivotal in this kind of a case. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who is, I think, in the more moderate wing of the court's conservative bloc, and also Chief Justice John Roberts, who is also now considered in the more moderate wing of the conservative bloc. And both of them seemed genuinely and fairly deeply troubled by the possibility of future prosecutions along these lines, namely a former president being prosecuted by the administration of his or her successor. That is a specter that Trump's lawyers repeatedly raised in the district court, in the Court of Appeals, and found no traction at all with those arguments down there. But here at the Supreme Court, they found a significant number of the conservative justices concerned about that. And perhaps a majority of the court, we'll see when the decision comes out. But that was what was really striking to me, that they were taking those concerns very, very seriously. And I think they signaled that for them, the chance of that kind of tit for tat prosecution maybe was more significant than the question of whether a president currently in office might feel sort of unleashed, might feel inhibited, or would feel constrained in their activities by the possibility of a criminal prosecution down the road.
And in terms of timing of the Donald Trump case, you write a lot about how they foresee that in order to make sure that the constraints about when to prosecute and when not to prosecute a former president, that this is going to take some time. Can you elaborate on that?
Right. So Trump had advanced an absolute immunity claim for a former president, at least for actions that were in the within the outer perimeter of his official duties, is the expression that the courts have used in similar types of cases in the past. And you know, the concern here and the pattern or the protocol that the conservative justices seem to be laying out was that somebody, either the trial court judge, in this case, who is Tanya Chutkan on the district court, or perhaps the D.C. Circuit, needed to go through the charges in this case and pick out which ones are alleging that Trump may have done something that is within his official capacity in some form, perhaps when he asked officials of the Justice Department to send letters to different states saying that their vote counts may not be correct and they needed to be reexamined. There might be fraud. That's Trump using arguably his official powers over the Justice Department versus other types of claims about what Trump did in the post-election period in 2020, like having his lawyers, you know, file certain protests or even file slates of what people are referring to as fraudulent or false electors. And, you know, the earlier rulings from the lower courts didn't make it as critical to separate those two categories because the lower courts said there's no immunity and probably no protection, no special protection for the president, even if this was his official duties, because we don't apply that in criminal cases. It's only been applied in civil cases. And the Supreme Court made pretty clear today that they're going to have a ruling that requires some jurists to segregate the official part of this case versus the personal slash political part. And obviously that'll take some time. And time, at least in advance of the election, is one thing that special counsel Jack Smith does not have much of.
We're talking with Josh Gerstein, senior legal affairs reporter for Politico. There was a lot of discussion today about former presidents taking actions that may have been crimes. What were the takeaways from those examples?
Well, we've seen those kinds of examples given in the trial court and in the court of appeals. You know, this being raised, frankly, by the lawyers on both sides of the case. On the Trump side of the case, they say things like drone strikes carried out when President Obama was in office. Somebody could come look at that later and say, you know, maybe that amounted to murder. You could have on the other side of the case, you had the prosecutors here saying that, you know, someone could order, you know, Navy SEALs or something to kill their opponent, their political opponent, and then say, no, that's part of my official duties. I have absolute immunity for it. And so those were the kinds of fairly extreme examples that the justices were wrestling with. One of the justices even brought an example of their own, talked about the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And, you know, would it be possible to pursue a civil rights prosecution against then President Roosevelt over that action if he were still alive and this had been undertaken back then. And so these are the sorts of examples that were floating around in the ether. I don't think the court will deal with any of them directly. The prosecutors for Jack Smith's office had explanations for why they didn't think that those would be viable criminal cases, but several justices thought that it was at least possible that you would find prosecutors that would investigate former presidents over things like that, whether or not criminal charges would eventually be brought.
There were some precedents cited by the lawyers, but has there ever been a Supreme Court case that touches directly on criminal presidential immunity?
No, there really hasn't been a case at all, because there really hasn't been a criminal case against a former president where this would be invoked. The closest thing you would have to a case like that would be the aftermath of President Nixon's resignation and the pardon that was issued by President Ford. That was discussed at the Supreme Court. You know, many who are on the Trump critic side or among the liberal justices say that that pardon amounted to an acknowledgement that a former president could face criminal charges for things he did while in office. Trump's lawyers came back at that and have come back at that in the past and said, well, you know, Nixon was facing the possibility of some charges related to things he did as a presidential candidate in a private capacity and not solely the things that he allegedly did as a in his presidential capacity. And so that therefore, maybe he didn't need a pardon for the private conduct. There may be some language in Ford's pardon that addresses a little bit of that. But at the same time, the way it was digested by the American public, I think, was clearly the notion that former President Nixon might have committed criminal offenses in office that related to his official work, and that President Ford was setting those aside with the pardon. And so that's part of why there really hasn't been a lot of discussion of this subject. There has, of course, been civil litigation against presidents and former presidents. You know, the most famous case probably being the one the Clinton versus Jones case against former President Clinton when he was still in office, where the Supreme Court allowed that case to go forward. But those are probably the closest analogs. And when those sorts of suits have had any bearing on the president's duties in office, the Supreme Court has said that they cannot go forward. They just have never answered this question of whether a criminal prosecution should be subject to those same rules.
And last question, when do you think the justices will issue a decision?
So this is pretty critical because if the special counsel is trying to get this case to trial before the election, which is something he hasn't really been willing to say up to this point on the record, but the urgency suggests that he is, Trump critics that have been speaking out publicly in recent days say the Supreme Court would need to issue a decision by around May 20th at the latest. Otherwise, the various processes it needs to go through to get to trial before the election seem to become very difficult. Normally, the Supreme Court releases its final opinions for the term by the end of June. So that's another time to look for a decision. But a decision that requires lower courts to parse through this indictment and perhaps to parse through a lot of the evidence may take even more time to implement. So I'm not even sure a decision by mid-May would necessarily get this case across the finish line before the election.
Josh Gerstein, Politico senior legal affairs reporter. His articles are at politico.com, and he's on X at Josh Gerstein. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Happy to do it.
And the Supreme Court oral argument in Trump v. U.S. argued today ran about 2 hours and 40 minutes. We covered it live on the C-SPAN networks. You can find the video at cspan.org. Here is part of it. Donald Trump's attorney, John Sauer, argued first. Justice Elena Kagan asked him how far presidential immunity from criminal prosecution could extend.
If a president orders the military to stage a coup.
I think that, as the Chief Justice pointed out earlier, where there is a whole series of, you know, sort of guidelines against that, so to speak, like the UCMJ prohibits the military from following a plainly unlawful act. If one adopted Justice Alito's test, that would fall outside. Now, if one adopts, for example, the Fitzgerald test that we advance, that may well be an official act, and he would have to be, as I'll say in response to all these kinds of hypotheticals, has to be impeached and convicted before he can be criminally prosecuted. But I emphasize to the court that—
Well, he's gone. Let's say this president who ordered the military to stage a coup. He's no longer president. He wasn't impeached. He couldn't be impeached. But he ordered the military to stage a coup, and you're saying that's an official act.
I think it would depend.
That's immune.
I think it would depend on the circumstances, whether it was an official act. If it were an official act, again, he would have to be impeached.
Well, what does that mean, depend on the circumstances? He was the president. He is the commander-in-chief. He talks to his generals all the time, and he told the generals, I don't feel like leaving office. I want to stage a coup. Is that immune?
If it's an official act, there needs to be impeachment and conviction beforehand because the framers viewed that kind of
if
very
it's an
low
official
risk.
Act, is it an official act?
If it's an official act, it's impeachment.
Is it an official act?
On the way you've described that hypothetical, it could well be. I just don't know. You'd have to, again, it's a fact-specific, context-specific determination.
That answer sounds to me as though it's like, yeah, under my test, it's an official act, but that sure sounds bad, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly sounds very bad, and that's why the framers have a whole series of structural checks that have successfully, for the last 234 years, prevented that very kind of extreme hypothetical. And that is the wisdom of the framers. What they viewed as the risk that needed to be guarded against was not the notion that the president might escape, you know, a criminal prosecution for something, you know, sort of very, very unlikely in these unlikely scenarios. They viewed much more likely and much more destructive to the republic the risk of factional strife discussed by George Washington.
The framers did not put an immunity clause into the Constitution. They knew how to. There were immunity clauses in some state constitutions. They knew how to give legislative immunity. They didn't provide immunity to the president. And, you know, not so surprising, they were reacting against a monarch who claimed to be above the law. Wasn't the whole point that the president was not a monarch and the president was not supposed to be above the law?
I would say two things in response to that. Immunity, they did put an immunity clause in. In a sense, they put in the executive vesting clause, which was originally understood to adopt a broad immunity principle that's set forth in the very broad language of Marbury against Madison. And also, they did discuss and consider what would be the checks on the presidency? And they did not say, oh, we need to have criminal prosecution. Right there at the Constitutional Convention, Benjamin Franklin says, we don't have that. That's not an option. Everybody cried out against that as unconstitutional. The structural check we're adopting is impeachment. And they're very clear on that in pages 64 to 69 of the second volume of Ferrand.
John Sauer, attorney for Donald Trump, questioned by Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan at the oral argument in the case Trump v. United States from today. Arguing for the federal government, Michael Dreeben, counselor to the Justice Department special counsel, who said there is no presidential immunity in the Constitution, and got questions from Justice Samuel Alito about some past controversial presidential actions and whether they could be prosecuted.
As members of the court have observed, it's baked into the Constitution that any president knows that they are exposed to potential criminal prosecution. My friend says after impeachment and conviction, we don't read the impeachment judgment clause that way, but we are. It's common ground that all former presidents have known that they could be indicted and convicted. And Watergate cemented that understanding. The Watergate smoking gun tape involved President Nixon and H.R. Haldeman talking about and then deciding to use the CIA to give a bogus story to the FBI to shut down a criminal investigation.
I mean, Mr. Sauer and others have identified events in the past where presidents have engaged in conduct that might have been charged as a federal crime. And you say, well, no, that's not really true. This is page 42 of your brief. So what about President Franklin D. Roosevelt's decision to intern Japanese Americans during World War II? Couldn't that have been charged under 18 U.S.C. 241, conspiracy against civil rights?
Today, yes, given this court's decision in Trump versus United States, in which Trump versus Hawaii, excuse me, where the court said Korematsu is overruled. I mean, President Roosevelt made that decision with the advice of his attorney general. That's a layer of
safeguard.
Is that
really true? I thought Attorney General Biddle thought that there was really no threat of sabotage, as did J. Edgar Hoover.
So I think that there is a lot of historical controversy, but it underscores that occurred during wartime. It implicates a potential commander-in-chief concerns about the exigencies of national defense that might provide an as-applied Article II challenge at the time. I'm not suggesting today, but the idea that a decision that was made and ultimately endorsed by this court, perhaps wrongly, in the Korematsu case, would support criminal prosecution under 241, which requires under United States versus Lanier that the right have been made specific so that there is notice to the president. I don't think that would have been satisfying.
Michael Dreeben, counselor to the Justice Department's special counsel, getting questions from Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito during the oral argument today in Trump v. U.S. An ABC News article has this: the outcome could determine whether Donald Trump faces a federal trial this year on 4 felony counts pressed by Special Counsel Jack Smith, including conspiracy to defraud the U.S. and obstruction of an official proceeding for his attempts to overturn the electoral vote count, certifying President Biden's victory. Demonstrators showed up outside the Supreme Court today, some calling on the justices to reject the claim of presidential immunity. On the sidewalk outside the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, in New York City, Donald Trump was attending his hush money criminal trial. He said he wanted to attend the Supreme Court oral argument in Washington, but was not allowed to. He spoke to reporters after the day was over.
And today we had a year because I was forced to be here, and I'm glad I was because it was a very interesting day in a certain way. But the U.S. Supreme Court had a monumental hearing on immunity and the immunity having to do with presidential immunity. And I think it was made clear, I hope it was made clear, that a president has to have immunity. You don't have a president, or at most you can say it would be a ceremonial president. That's not what the founders had in mind. They're not talking about ceremonial. We want presidents that can get things done and bring people together. So I heard the meeting was quite amazing. quite amazing, and the justices were on their game. So let's see how that all turns out. But again, I say presidential immunity, very powerful presidential immunity is imperative, or you practically won't have a country anymore.
Former President Donald Trump, a 2024 Republican presidential candidate today in New York City, as he left the courtroom as the trial continues, criminal charges against him alleging falsified business records to cover a payoff to keep an alleged sexual affair from being made public before the 2016 presidential election. President Joe Biden went to Syracuse, New York today to announce the preliminary agreement between the Department of Commerce and the company Micron to provide up to $6.1 billion in direct funding, another $7.5 billion in loans for the building of a computer chip making facility. Micron says it could employ up to 9,000 people at an average of $100,000 per year each, and the $100 billion development could create 40,000 spin-off jobs. Before the president arrived, though, WSTM-TV in Syracuse reported that President Biden will be in Syracuse on Thursday. The city's police union president sees the timing as extremely poor, believing the White House brushed aside concerns about the grief that officers are suffering after saying goodbye to two of their own. PBA President Joseph Moran said, "The presidential detail that's coming here is not sitting well with the membership, not now." That was the reporting from the local station WSTM-TV in Syracuse. When President Biden spoke today, he began on that topic.
You know, before I start, I want to take a moment to honor two officers who I already mentioned, two fallen heroes who were killed in the line of duty this month, Lieutenant Michael Hosek and County Sheriff Department, and Syracuse Police Officer Michael Jensen. We pray for their loved ones whose hearts have been broken. You know, every time a police officer puts on that shield every morning, their husband or wife, whatever it is, or child, worries about, will they get that phone call? Will they get that phone call? I got one of those phone calls in a different circumstance. Find out you've lost part of your soul, lost part of your heart. For the entire Syracuse community is grieving, and we're grieving with you. You know, to the men and women of law enforcement here and across the country, you represent the best of us. You really do. It's one of the toughest jobs in America. One of the toughest jobs. And to the families, who I hope to get to meet shortly, I say my heart goes out to you. Thank you, and God bless you all.
President Biden in Syracuse. It was the start of his speech that he then went on to talk about new funding announced under the CHIPS and Science Act. He spoke at the Museum of Science and Technology in Syracuse.
Together with Schumer Leader and I, we took action to make sure these chips were made in America again, creating tens of thousands, and I mean tens of thousands of good-paying jobs, bringing prices down for everyone. In 2022, together with Leader Schumer, we wrote the CHIPS and Science Act. We used to invest significant amounts of money in research and development. We stopped doing it, but I was determined we were going to do it again. It's one of the most significant science and technology investments in our history. And 2 months later, I came to Syracuse to celebrate Micron's historic plan to build the biggest semiconductor manufacturing site in all of America, one of the biggest in the world. As was mentioned, it's the size of, going to be the size of 40 football fields, 40, big enough to fit four carrier domes inside and still have space left over. Today, I'm pleased to announce we're building on that commitment with a landmark preliminary agreement between my administration and Micron, a major chip manufacturer, which is building these fabs here in upstate New York. $6.1 billion in CHIPS funding, paired with $125 billion from Micron to build these facilities here in New York and near Micron headquarters in Idaho. And I, you know, by the way, it's been mentioned before, it's the single biggest private investment ever in the history of these two states, Idaho and, you know, New York. So far from, not far from here, in Clay, New York, is going to help build 2 to 4 manufacturing facilities planned by Micron's Mega Labs. And Boise, Ohio, is going to help build new high-volume manufacturing fabs as well. In all, it's going to create over 70,000 jobs across both states, at least 9,000 of which are construction jobs, 11,000 manufacturing jobs, tens of thousands more up and down the supply chain. and it includes 9,000 permanent Micron manufacturing jobs right here in Clay, not here, but near in Clay, just a little bit from here. Many of them paying, catch this, $100,000 a year. And it doesn't require a college degree.
President Biden in Syracuse, New York. He was joined by Governor Kathy Hochul and the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, both Democrats. Wall Street today, the Dow down 375, NASDAQ down 100, S&P down 23. Story from Bloomberg, the surprisingly sharp downshift in the U.S. economic growth last quarter masked otherwise resilient household demand and business investment that helped generate faster inflation. Gross domestic product advanced at a 1.6% annualized rate below all economists' projections, with the biggest restraints stemming from less inventory accumulation and a wider trade gap. That was from Bloomberg. From Fox Business, the Federal Communications Commission on Thursday voted to approve a regulation that will reinstate net neutrality rules that allow the agency to regulate broadband internet access as a telecommunications service. Net neutrality rules were first imposed during the Obama administration in 2015, but were repealed in 2017 after the Trump administration flipped control of the FCC, which returned broadband internet to being regulated as an information service. With the Biden administration having returned the FCC to a majority of Democratic appointees, the agency is reinstating net neutrality rules that allow broadband to be regulated under Title II of the Communications Act. That was from Fox Business. The vote today was 3-2, party line, the three Democratic commissioners voting yes, the two Republican commissioners voting no. The chair, Democrat Jessica Rosenworcel, spoke before the vote.
4 years ago, the pandemic changed life as we know it. We were told to stay home, hunker down, and live online. So much of work, school, and healthcare migrated to the internet. If we wanted to engage with the world, we needed to do it all through a broadband connection. It became clear that no matter who you are or where you live, you need broadband to have a fair shot at digital age success. It went from nice to have to need to have for everyone, everywhere. Broadband is now an essential service. Essential services, the ones we count on in every aspect of modern life, have some basic oversight. So let's be clear about what we are doing today. This agency, the nation's leading communications authority, believes every consumer deserves internet access that is fast, open, and fair. That is why we determined that the Federal Communications Commission should be able to assist consumers and take action when it comes to the most important communications of our time, and that's broadband. This is common sense. But in a world where up is down and down is up, the last FCC threw this authority away and decided broadband needed no supervision. As a result, it tossed out net neutrality policies grounded in Title II of the Communications Act that have deep origins in communications law and history. These net neutrality policies ensured you can go where you want and do what you want online without your broadband provider making choices for you. They make clear your broadband provider should not have the right to block websites, slow services, or censor online content. These policies were court-tested and approved. They were wildly popular. In fact, studies show that 80% of the public support the FCC's net neutrality policies and opposed their repeal. Now for a plot twist. After the last FCC took away these policies, despite this broad public outcry, a curious thing happened. When Washington stepped out, California rode in with its own open internet regime. Other states, too. All in all, nearly a dozen put net neutrality rules into state law, executive orders, and contracting policies. So in effect, we have net neutrality policies that providers are abiding by right now across this country. They're just coming from Sacramento and places like it. I think in a modern digital economy, we should have a national net neutrality policy and make clear the nation's expert on communications has the ability to act when it comes to broadband. This is good for consumers, good for public safety, and good for national security. And that is why we are taking this action under Title II of the Communications Act today.
Chair of the Federal Communications Commission, Jessica Rosenworcel, a Democrat, at today's meeting in Washington. Commissioner Brendan Carr, Republican, spoke against the proposal to reinstitute the net neutrality rules before the vote.
And today's order is not about correcting a market failure. Broadband access is more vibrant and competitive than ever, no matter how you slice the reams of data. Americans benefited from lower prices, faster speeds, broader coverage, increased competition, and accelerated internet builds. In fact, here's what the data show. Internet speeds are up 430% since 2017. On the fixed broadband side, they're up 647% on the mobile side. The prices for internet services have dropped in real terms by about 9%. Now, if you look just on the mobile broadband side alone, real prices have dropped by roughly 18% since 2017. And for the most popular broadband speed tiers, real prices are down 54%. And for the fastest broadband speed tiers, they're down 55% over the last 8 years. The FCC realizes that the old justifications for Title II will no longer cut it. So as if nothing ever happened, as if we just shake an Etch-a-Sketch, the old predictions were not just disproven, they've been abandoned. And the agency invents entirely new justifications. The FCC throws whatever it can think of against the wall to see if anything sticks. The order now claims Title II is necessary for national security, for public safety, for law enforcement, for robocall mitigation, for poll attachments, for accessibility, for privacy and cybersecurity. The list goes on and on. But the FCC's latest set of claims fares no better than those they trotted out in 2015. They're simply new pretext to justify an old power grab. Take national security. The FCC has identified no gap in national security that Title II would fill. Rather, the record makes clear that Congress has already empowered agencies with national security expertise, including Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, Commerce, and Treasury, to address these issues in the communications sector.
Brendan Carr, Federal Communications Commission Commissioner, one of the Republicans, before the vote to put net neutrality back in place. The three Democratic commissioners voting yes, the two Republican commissioners voting no. An article from Politico reads, the order will go into effect 60 days after publication in the Federal Register, but the future of the rules is less certain given a variety of threats on the horizon. If former President Donald Trump wins re-election, a GOP-led FCC would likely repeal the rules. The telecom industry is also expected to file a legal challenge, although Jessica Rosenworcel has defended the plan as court-tested, given an earlier legal victory involving the 2015 rules. There will also be pushback from top Republicans on Capitol Hill. Rosenworcel and her fellow commissioners will testify May 7th before the House Energy and Commerce Telecom Subcommittee, which will likely feature much discussion of net neutrality. That was from Politico. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan from C-SPAN, along with my colleague, Ben. Since C-SPAN's founding 45 years ago, the media world has changed. Remember when there were just a few TV channels? Now we've got streaming, social media, apps, and more.
Through all of this, C-SPAN has stayed true to its mission of giving you unfiltered access to government wherever you get your news. As we navigate this challenging media environment with fewer people subscribing to traditional cable packages, our funding has been impacted.
That's why we're asking for your help to keep going strong for another 45 years. Please donate today at cspan.org/donate. Your contribution, large or small, helps ensure at least another 45 years of witnessing democracy in action.
Keep C-SPAN thriving in today's ever-changing media landscape. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your gift today. Thank you.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, writes Reuters, said on Wednesday more has to be done to stop pro-Palestinian protests that have spread across U.S. campuses in recent weeks. Protests over Israel's actions in Gaza have intensified across U.S. campuses, with the Gaza war now in its seventh month. Pro-Palestinian protesters have called for a ceasefire and for their universities to divest from companies with ties to Israel. Dozens of students have been docked, suspended by the university, and arrested by police. Some Jewish and Israeli students and faculty have said the protests have turned universities into a hostile environment where they feel threatened. That was reporting from Reuters. Here's part of the video from Prime Minister Netanyahu.
What's happening on America's college campuses is horrific. Anti-Semitic mobs have taken over leading universities. They call for the annihilation of Israel. They attack Jewish students. They attack Jewish faculty. This is reminiscent of what happened in German universities in the 1930s. It's unconscionable. It has to be stopped. It has to be condemned and condemned unequivocally. But that's not what happened. The response of several university presidents was shameful. Now, fortunately, state, local, federal officials, many of them have responded differently, but there has to be more. More has to be done.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in a video released by his office today, questions at the State Department briefing in Washington to the deputy spokesperson, Vedant Patel.
Yesterday, the Israeli Prime Minister called for a crackdown on pro-Palestinian protesters in the United States of America. Do you find this to be a gross, a galling interference in American affairs? I mean, especially from a leader of a country that had just received $26 billion of American taxpayer money. You find that to be annoying or in any way interfering in the affairs of the American public and exercising their right to demonstrate?
Well, Saeed, I will leave it to the Prime Minister's office to offer any clarification on his comments, but I don't believe he called for a crackdown. Let me just say, though, that
He literally called for a crackdown.
Let's be real about the facts, Saeed, which is that in the aftermath of October 7th, we are very much seeing a surge in anti-Semitism across the world. And its tragedy demands action. Beyond that, though, we, of course, support the right of anybody to peacefully protest, to demonstrate, to make their voices heard, to express themselves in a peaceful and nonviolent way. Right. However, we also believe that harmful rhetoric, whether it be rooted in anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, is incredibly problematic and needs to be condemned and called out against. But beyond that, as it relates to the individual policies that are being pursued in dealing with these demonstrations on individual college campuses, I would defer to the local jurisdictions to speak to that.
State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel getting questions from Palestinian-American journalist Saeed Erekat, who's Washington Bureau Chief with Al-Quds Daily. Times of Israel has a story. A senior member of Hamas's Qatar-based Politburo said in an interview with the Associated Press on Wednesday the terrorist group is willing to agree to a truce of 5 years or more with Israel and that it would lay down its weapons and convert into a political party if an independent Palestinian state is established along pre-1967 borders. However, in separate comments published by the London-based Arabic paper Al-Arabi Al-Jadid, the same official indicated this would only be a temporary stance and that the Palestinians retain their historic right to all Palestinian lands. Also, the Biden administration is appointing a new coordinator for humanitarian aid to Gaza. Lise Grande, currently CEO and president of U.S. Institute of Peace, will take over for David Satterfield. From Voice of America, the United States will send a delegation to Niger on Thursday to begin face-to-face talks with officials on withdrawing the more than 1,000 American personnel in the military-ruled country. Niger has been a key base for regional counterterrorism operations, but the government, a military junta that ousted the country's president last year, said in March it was ending a military cooperation agreement with Washington. That was from Voice of America. This came up today at the Pentagon briefing with the press secretary, Pat Ryder.
U.S. Ambassador to Niger, Kathleen Fitzgibbon, and Major General Kenneth Ekman, U.S. Africa Command Director of Strategy, Engagement, and Programs, will meet with the National Council for Safeguarding the Homeland officials today in Niamey, Niger, to initiate discussions on an orderly and safe withdrawal of U.S. forces from Niger. Subsequently, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict, Christopher Mayer, and Lieutenant General Dagvin Anderson, Joint Staff Director for Joint Force Development, will conduct follow-up meetings in Niamey next week to coordinate the withdrawal process in a transparent manner and with mutual respect. We'll be sure, of course, to keep you updated regarding any significant developments. In the meantime, the Department of Defense remains committed to countering violent extremist organizations in West Africa. The department will continue to support whole-of-government approaches to work with African leaders to maintain stability and address terrorist threats in the region, including addressing core issues that drive insecurity.
The Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder, an Air Force Major General, at his news conference. From Associated Press, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken raised what the U.S. describes as unfair Chinese trade practices during his first full day of meetings in China on Thursday with local government officials in the financial hub of Shanghai. Blinken met with the city's top official and raised concerns about Chinese trade practices and non-market economic practices, the State Department said in a statement. It said he stressed the U.S. seeks healthy economic competition with China and a level playing field for U.S. workers and firms operating in China. Asked about Blinken's comments, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin said China has always conducted economic and trade cooperation in accordance with market principles, firmly supported the multilateral trading system, and fully complied with the rules of the World Trade Organization. That was reporting from Associated Press. Secretary Blinken also met while in Shanghai with the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai.
Well, it's wonderful to be here. First of all, thanks to each of you for taking time. I wanted to make sure being here in Shanghai, the hub of so much economic activity and also a real hub of connection between the United States and China when it comes to business, when it comes to trade, that I had a chance to hear directly from you who are engaged in this market, engaged in this relationship, because it's so extraordinarily consequential. And one of the things that President Biden and President Xi agreed when they met in San Francisco was that we have to continue to find ways to put as much stability as possible into the relationship to make sure that we're managing the relationship responsibly, which we're committed to doing. A big part of that is making sure that the economic relationship is working in the ways that it should work to mutual benefit. And so it's important for me to hear what's working, what's not, and also to be able to reflect any concerns that you have in our own engagements with the government, where obviously decisions are made that have a profound impact on the way you're able to do business. We have, as you know, a relationship that has us as the largest market for products that are made in China. That remains the case. China's our third largest trading partner after our two near neighbors, Canada and Mexico, and of course, foreign direct investment here, including American investment, is among the leading investors of any country in the world. So we want to make sure that we are effectively looking out for the interests of our own community, and the best way to do that is to start by actually hearing my community. So that's what I want to do today. Thanks.
Thank you, great.
Thank you.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Shanghai, China, meeting with members of the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai. He also met today with students at New York University's Shanghai campus. He attended a professional basketball game and met with Chinese government officials. And we'll have more meetings on Friday, including a possible meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. This is Washington Today. Story from Forbes. Kim Kardashian will attend a White House roundtable discussion Thursday alongside Vice President Kamala Harris and four individuals granted clemency by the Biden administration this week, multiple outlets reported, as the billionaire reality TV star continues the criminal justice reform advocacy she gained recognition for during the Trump administration. That was the preview from Forbes. During the roundtable, Vice President Kamala Harris asked Kim Kardashian to say a few words.
I just wanted to start off by thanking you, Madam Vice President, for hosting this event today and just for your deep commitment to second chances.
Thank you.
Also, I wanted to thank President Biden for all of the commutations and the pardons that are happening. It was actually this very room that I was in years ago, my first clemency meeting, that really inspired me to take a journey of really helping to figure out how I can be helpful and how I can tell the amazing stories that I would hear from the success stories from individuals like yourself. And I didn't know a whole lot, and I was inspired to go to law school and really further my education to see what I can do to help and not rely on these two women behind me who would come with me everywhere, my attorneys, to kind of translate everything for me, because I really couldn't grasp what all of this means. And I know you guys live this, that this has been your life, so I'm sure you understand the system and the paperwork and everything so much better than so many people. And I am super honored to be here to hear your stories today. And I think it's so important to share them and amplify them, because there's so many people that are in your position that can use the inspiration. And I'm so honored to be here to continue this fight and to learn more every day, every visit, every administration. I'm just here to help and to spread the word. So I'm so excited to be here and hear your story. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you for having me.
Kim Kardashian at a White House roundtable with Vice President Kamala Harris and some of the people granted clemency this week. It was part of Second Chance Month, which promotes post-incarceration rehabilitation and reentry programs. Story from Reuters says that during today's meeting, Vice President Harris announced the finalization of a Small Business Administration rule that will remove most restrictions on loan eligibility based on a person's criminal record. Today is National Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Day. And the Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder said it gave him an idea about a new energy source for the Defense Department.
First of all, we want to welcome all the young people, yourselves included, who are working with their parents today at the Pentagon as part of our annual Take a Child to Work Day. It's estimated that we have somewhere near 10,000 young guests here today, and it's been exciting to have their energy and their voices echoing in the corridors of the Pentagon. I'm pretty sure I've seen a few kids with light-up shoes that make them run faster, so I've reached out to the Defense Innovation Unit to talk about that.
Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder, Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Day started as Take Our Daughters to Work Day in 1992 and then was expanded to include sons in 2003. According to Forbes, in 2018, over 37 million people at over 3.5 million workplaces took part. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and you'll get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.